Hi, everybody. This is Joanne from Read Science, and we are glad you can join us. I am joined, of course, by my co-host Jeff Schomeyer as we meet once again with an author to talk about their book and how they communicate science to the general public in engaging and compelling ways. And I'm so excited because I have a long history with this lady. My former co-blogger and good pal, Karen Bondar. Karen, say hi to our audience.
Hello, everybody. It's so awesome to be here and especially to be chatting with you again, Joanne.
Yay, I know. It's so exciting. It's just like, yeah, with the demise of our favorite conference, Science Online. It's like, when do we get to talk? And we both have four kids, and it's too busy. So I'm going to, you know, you can learn about Karen everywhere. She's easily Googleable, and you find these cute pictures of her and all this stuff and fun videos. And we will talk about some of her videos in addition to her book. But we are talking today about her book. This is the American version called Wild Sex, which if you leave on your nightstand like that or like this, people will be like, whoa, you know. But if you read the full subtitle, maybe it's less exciting. unless you're a biologist, which then it's really exciting. So this is Science Behind Mating in the Animal Kingdom. And, you know, we will learn a lot of biology in this book. I know she used a lot of words. We'll talk about this, the concepts and words that biologists use. And it was, you know, great fun to read. So, anyway, I'm going to read your bio from the back because if we read everything you've done, it would be so long.
Oh.
Dr. Karen Bondar received a PhD in population ecology from the University of British Columbia and has since hosted a variety of online and television programs, working with Scientific American, National Geographic Wild, and the Science Channel. She's currently the lead presenter on Discovery World's Brave New World with Stephen Hawking. Her independent web series, Wild Sex, produced by Earth Touch Online, has over 50 million views, and her TED Global Talk in Edinburgh in 2013 has received over 2 million views, and she lives in British Columbia, Canada. And I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yay. So, Jeff.
Yes.
You are the first question man.
Yeah.
As always, it's the biologist ganging up on the physicist.
Yeah. We usually pass it over to the Dr. Watson of the day to get things started. And so I'm the non-biologist, and I get to be amazed by all these biological things. And I finished the book, and I found that there were a couple of ideas that were sort of hovering near each other. And I've been trying to turn them into a question. I don't think I've gotten there yet. But this is sort of an essay statement about two different things. One is, and you, this is one of your avowed thing purposes in writing the book, and maybe I'll quote something later, was to enlighten a lot of people about how diverse sexual behavior is in the animal kingdom, and at the same time, how parochial our view of human sex and what's natural and required can be. At the same time that I was thinking of these hundreds, thousands of examples that you give us of interesting behaviors and their evolutionary aspects. And so the other part of that was how fecund natural selection is, just to fill every possible thing. And if we can think of it, natural selection has done it. And if we can't think of it, natural selection has probably done it. So, you know, the question is a response to something like, gosh, there's a lot of crazy stuff that goes on out there. But I don't know what the question is, but like natural selection really does all this stuff and doesn't repress very much. And this is going to be a shocker for some people, isn't it? I mean, do you get people reacting that way? It's like, I can't believe that people go around, you know, sticking their sexual organs into other animals' foreheads.
Yeah, and you know, and I've even had people sort of on the far side of flip side of that coin to sort of say, you see, that is so out there and so weird. Evolution couldn't possibly have done that. That has to have been created somehow, because WTF, really.
Yeah. Although my reaction, but remember that, you know, I'm a hardcore scientist reductionist, and I was reading this, and you can't read about anything evolutionary without thinking about the non-evolutionary types. And I read this, and I thought, what creator in his right mind would invent so many weird behaviors? It just seemed like, you know, 5 or 10, this is good creativity, but tens of thousands of ways to do it, and, you know, what's the deal with hermaphrodites and all that,
and yeah.
snails, and what are they up to? But this is before we even get to the blue-footed boobies, which I'm with you. They've got a lot going for them. But that's, well, maybe we should do that. That's one detail where, who would have imagined, okay, you talk about the blue-footed booby, and you tell us, and I've seen enough David Attenborough, so the feet, the color of the feet on the guy is sexually selected.
That's right, yeah.
Right, so it's one version of the way selection works, and it's often natural selection, but sexual selection we've come to see is a big thing, right? So the female says, I like the guy with the nice, shiny, bright blue feet. And so you describe, I guess, an experiment. We learn that the female blue-footed booby lays 2 eggs 4 days apart. And if after she lays the first egg, you paint the guy's feet gray, the second egg ends up with fewer resources for the chick to feed on than they did before, lowering its place in the survivability thing. Tell me a little bit more about that if you have some background. It's nice to know that there are experiments, that you can see these things happen, this whole thing of the selection. But as we just learned, we talked to Ed Young about microbes and found that they're responsible for a lot more. Who knew that this stuff goes on, that I don't know, enzymes and hormones and things go on, and that stuff happens based on this guy's feet color?
Yeah. You know, I love this example because it provides such a perfect look at maternal investment, which is sort of what this this example illustrates. Now, we have these feet, and the feet are a direct measure of his health, which, you know, and I laugh at humans because we do so many things to make ourselves beautiful that are outside of our health. And, you know, so in the natural world, in the animal kingdom, health is beauty, and beauty is health. It's not the same for our species, but that's maybe a topic for a little bit later. So if the female sees he has these great big gorgeous blue feet, she's thinking, okay, perfect. Great mate. Love this guy. He's awesome. I want, you know, this, there's chances of having a very, very healthy, biologically fit offspring with this guy are very good. And so the level of control that she has that this illustrates is phenomenal. She lays that first egg, as you said, in the system with the blue-footed boobies. After one act of copulation, the female will generally lay 2 eggs. The first one comes along right away. Second one comes along 4 days later. So she lays that first egg. It's full of nutrients. And, I mean, female birds, we don't even understand this.
Yes,
one iota, really. The level of control, of the complexity of things she can include in this perfect little package, this egg, hormones, sugars, various chemical defenses, all these kinds of things, she can either gear this baby up or perhaps not. And so that first egg comes along and it's healthy and it's beautiful and it's packed jam full of all these things to help it along. And then biologists went in between the laying of the 2 eggs, painted the male's feet gray, and then looked at what she did. And what she did is exactly what you would assume based on biological fitness. Oh, hold on. This guy's horrible. He's not healthy. He's not good. And so they decreased the nutrients and everything that the second egg was provisioned with. And, you know, something like that, it's sort of, I love to think of things in terms of what that would look like if it was a human, you know? And so you have, you know, the captain of the football team, you know what I mean, who was there, your first catch, and then all of a sudden you have I don't know whomever who's less fit in your opinion, the deadbeat dad kind of thing, who's the second guy. And so it's humans don't think about that. You know, we sort of think about treating our children and our offspring all the same. But biologically speaking, if they all come from different dads, and if you're the female, there's a different level of biological fitness associated with each mm-hmm. child. But we kind of remove ourselves from that, rightly so, as far as our social game goes. But it is very interesting to look at the pure biology there. The birds aren't really thinking about how to be socially acceptable or politically mm-hmm. correct. They're just mm-hmm. thinking about biological fitness, and that's the cool bit.
And now, we pretty much use our human blinders to do these things, and I'm wondering what you see in the progress of our understanding over the last 100 years or so, where in order to do this experiment with the blue-footed booby, which seems a straightforward experiment when we think about it now, you have to ask the question and wonder about this. Nobody would have asked this question even 80 years ago, because nobody would have thought that something like this might have an interesting outcome or anything. How does our view of animal sexuality and reproduction and fitness and things change over time as our own parochial view with our mm-hmm. human blinders on opens up a little bit? When did we start, realizing that the world is a bigger, weirder place than we knew.
Right, yeah, and it's not necessarily so simple as maximizing biological fitness, mm-hmm. whatever that means to any particular animal. And I think there's a two-way street here. We've both learned from the animal kingdom as far as the perverse diversity of so many things that go on, and then there's us humans sort of, doing our missionary position behind closed doors underneath mm-hmm. sheets, just going, whoa, sex is bad, we shouldn't be, this is a secret thing that we do. Guess what, world? It's totally not. I mean, for most animals, it's as plain as having lunch or dinner. And this is why most animals you see have really no shame in just engaging in sexual copulations wherever they happen to be. It's not a big deal. However, the reverse side of that, and I think this is a really interesting area, is that as humans kind of progress in our understanding of sexuality, and the thing that comes to mind is LGBTQ issues, mm-hmm. and the whole notion of transgenderism, which is something that's gaining a lot more respect and understanding in popular media, we as biologists start to ask questions like, well, are there transgender animals? And mm-hmm. and if there are, how would we know? Mm-hmm. And these are questions that I think about a lot, especially when it comes to animals like the great apes that are so closely related to us, genetically speaking, biologically speaking, behaviorally speaking, and how are trans apes mm-hmm. received in their communities, and what are sort of the ways in which they go through with living, with biological fitness, with their own lives. And we would be foolish to think that doesn't happen.
Well, and you described somewhere some of the females mimic male versions mm-hmm. or vice versa or something. Anyway, this starts to come close, but in order to see that, you have to have the frame of mind that allows you to see that to begin with. And 80 years ago, 120 years ago, people would observe primate behavior and say, well, they couldn't possibly be doing this.
Yeah.
And, this is the thing that goes parallel. Questions like, well, of course there are no intelligent animals because we're the peak of the evolutionary ladder. And by golly, if animals don't keep turning out to be more intelligent than we think, and we're going to be real surprised by some of that
Absolutely.
Someday, right? And then, you mentioned it, but what is the deal with humans and this closed door thing about sexuality? Is this some sort of selective behavior at work here?
That's a great question, because it's something that's come up with me quite recently in sort of working out new sort of thought patterns in my own mind. It's almost as though we, if there's such a thing as de-evolving, mm-hmm. it's a horrible term to say, but so we're equally related to to two groups of apes, the chimps and the bonobos. And chimps mm-hmm. have a very different sexual system than the bonobos do, as I'm sure you're aware. Chimps have a very coercive, a very mm-hmm. male-dominated sexual system that we probably are closer to than that of the bonobos, which is mm-hmm. pretty much just free-for-all, let's all have sex all the time, let's use sex as a tool to communicate, to resolve conflict, to make babies, but also to do so many other things, and you know, all kinds of
diverse sex. Sometimes it seems more nurturing or more
absolutely
dual rather than the aggressive fight that goes on with chimps.
That's exactly what it is, and that's it, and it's interesting that there's this sort of make love not war scenario over here, and then there's this coercive, I control you kind of system, and we've gravitated towards that of the chimps, and I think, you know, sort of earlier human societies where monogamy became the thing sort of led us to become close-minded, and we have this notion of monogamy and this notion of the couple with the two children or whatever it is that you have and the picket fence, and the fact that all of your sexual activities take place, you know, in sort of this hidden environment mm-hmm. with each other exclusively. But then we see this almost notion of the biology bursting itself out of those walls when things like the Ashley Madison hack mm-hmm. happened, or yeah. the mere notion of the pornography industry. I mean, there's sex and biology in there that's banging its way out. Yeah. And we have to look at, you know, why have we gone through this sort of this phase, perhaps this era of enforcing some kind of sexual rules on ourselves,
a lot of social structures to consider too. And one story that I had received that may or may not think is like that medieval peasants were much more like bonobos and chimpanzees when it came to their sex life. They didn't give two hoots who was around a thing. When they got randy, they did it. And then we also get the story that as there was the idea of primogeniture and succession involved with nobility, and that nobility, in order to maintain that, meant being able to know who the father was, which is much harder to tell than who the mother was, because everything depended on who the father was. Therefore, you developed, started to accrete all of these rules in order to be able to tell, or to specify, if not tell, who the father was. And so what a nice conflict you get, and you set the stage for Freud to come along and say, ah, the neuroses that come about from the conflict between these two structures of sex as a normal, natural thing, that I think we have room for a quotation from you that says, your main goal in writing this book was to enlighten the reader to the fact that sex is a part of almost all decisions made by animals, and it contributes to virtually every facet of social organization and community formation. And if you deny, I mean, we spend so much time denying that sex is fundamental. We think of it as optional, the way we think of, I don't know, music education in schools or art. And it just is not. And so you're obviously going to get these conflicts, like senators who keep passing laws to protect themselves, mm-hmm. like, please make me stop. There's just huge conflicts. It's like, are we going to get over that, or is it going to get worse, maybe?
Yeah, it's a real tough question, and I think because in humans we have this huge brain that conflicts with a lot of these basic processes. And I mean, you know, there are virtually no monogamous mammals. We mm-hmm. would be the only one if we were indeed monogamous, which I'm not sure we are. But this whole notion of who is the father, that's the crux of the situation. I mean, we have internal fertilization. We have a female, in the case of a human, who is out of reproductive commission and probably mostly sexual commission for 9 months, while the male is sitting there going, okay, what do I do now? And in the rest of the animal kingdom, the male is going, okay, well, I will go and increase my biological fitness elsewhere, thanks very much, since there is nothing I can do that's biologically relevant mm-hmm. at this point. It doesn't make any sense for him to stick around. And that's why we don't see monogamy in mammals. We just don't see it. When you take that situation, but what you add the human brain, which says, mm-hmm. okay, well, you know, you're the father of my child, so you need to stick around and rub my feet, I guess, or something, for the 9 months that I'm gestating our child. You have these roles to play, and I don't want you to play any other biological role elsewhere. You know, and me personally, I'm a prime example of that because I, you know, on paper, all of this non-monogamy stuff makes perfect sense to me as a biologist. However, I do not want my fiancé being with anybody else. You know, I am monogamous when it comes to my own personal life. And mm-hmm. I don't think that's my biology speaking. That's my human brain with my complex suite of emotions and all of the things that go along with my, you know, insecurity and my psyche and all of, you know, maybe some of those things Freud was talking about, although I do think that Freud was very obsessed with the actual physical act of sex itself.
But some inclination towards sexual fidelity does seem pretty deep down.
Yes.
And it's like, and where does that come from? It's not really rational.
Or is the way we're thinking not really rational? I think that the frivolity of sex is rational, but we just need to remember that our brains allow that. We want to quash it down.
Yes.
Right. You know, I was thinking, I really, you know, this is going to sound such a biologist. I actually appreciated your postscript of all things. Your postscript, because you said, I mean, you know, and as I'm reading your book, I see the themes. I know that theme, because I'm a biologist. But I felt like what you did, you repeated and you kept informing, and then I felt like it was great that you actually took the postscript and say, you know what, for good measure, let's look at these biological themes again. You know, what themes did we see over and over? Because actually, you know, for those who haven't read her book and think, oh, I don't know if I want to read biology, I don't know if I want to do this. Actually, the chapters are very short, mm-hmm. and they've got, you know, they've got some pop culture references and you know, sayings we say all the time. So it's not inaccessible. So, you know, if you've seen her, Karen on video, then you know you're going to get a book you can understand. But, you know, so I was thinking, you know, you listed these main themes, gamete value, come on, I know how to say that, evolution at multiple scales, homosexuality, hermaphrodites and parasites, us versus them, you know, and I thought this was really valuable. Oh, and you have a really super nice glossary.
Oh, right.
You know, for those who go, what?
It's very valuable, yeah.
It's a valuable glossary. So, of all the things you talked about, what would you say was the most, I don't know, I can choose any word and you can talk about it, but most, the thing that resonated with you most as a biologist that you thought, I really have to talk about this?
You know, that is a tough question because there are a lot, but I guess I would say, I just love the us versus them because that is sort of how my brain works, and that's kind of how I've been thinking ever since I was an undergrad. I always have kind of just wanted to put the way humans think, the way I think personally, because, you know, I know how I think, but the way humans kind of think in general into how can we fit that with what we understand about animals, because it's kind of funny how we, especially as biologists, ascribe so many attributes, so many themes in biology, theories, hypotheses. We ascribe those to the rest of the animal kingdom, but not to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of ways in which we don't fit in, but I think that there's a lot of ways in which we do fit in, and then there's a lot of ways in which the animal kingdom grows much further out of these rules and generalizations that we have. And and just kind of a note too about the writing, I have a very short attention span. I've never been too good at the long form, and so, you know, writing a book was just kind of like, oh, I don't know. But so yeah, the book is itself kind of almost like a series of blog posts for me, because I like to kind of take a topic, have what is the crux here, what is the human connection here, and talk about it briefly and then move to the next thing. So yeah, and that's kind of how my videos go and how blogging went when we were doing it, and then yeah, how the book goes as well. So yeah, but I think the us versus them That's a big one, and that's something that I continue to think about all the time, in everything, in anything. I mean, I'm a mom, as you are, Joanne. We, you know, when we do our parenting, how are we doing this? How is it different? How does it look the same? How does it look different? You know, there's so many ways to sort of tackle those topics when you get rid of the, you know, ego that comes with being human.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's a basic comparison. You know, which we can do when we just say we're going to look at this logically. So we both have mentioned your videos. So let's sort of talk about how this all began. And well, you've had a long path, but let's start with the Wild Sex series from Earth Touch.
Yeah, that was just, I would say, one of those projects that really changed my life. I had been blogging for a while and noticing that people were more interested in sex when sex was the topic, when there was just something, you know, some crazy penis or, you know, some violent act or something. People were just always very, very interested in, you know, because we are, as you know, you were pointing out earlier, Jeff, it's like people are just fascinated by sex. We just are. It's part of everything. So just fortuitously, I had done an interview for Valentine's Day, I believe it was, just kind of going, okay, romance in the animal kingdom, no. And a producer at Earth Touch saw it, and they had, you know, interest in doing a series, an online series about sex. And this is, you know, it's funny because this, I feel so old when I say this, but this was before kind of the big YouTuber days. You know, this was back in 2012 or something. Like it was before it was a huge deal to do something online, and they had some resources to get this series done, which again was kind of unheard of at
unheard
the time
of.
For an online
still
series.
A little hard too.
Yeah, yeah, still is. So, you know, we just took a chance. I flew over to South Africa, which is where they were located, and we shot 21 episodes in like 9 days. It was crazy and amazing and one of the best experiences of my life. And we went for it. And I think, Joanne, we've talked about this before too. We, you know, was that this is not your blue chip natural history series as narrated by David Attenborough. This is me dressed up like a hooker on a street corner in Durban in the middle of the night talking about prostitution in the animal kingdom, you know, and they had this 15-meter-long penis made to kind of just illustrate the biological or the sort of size differences in terms of how it might look if a human had a barnacle penis and things like that. And it was, you know, I had my fingers crossed when it first came out because it was just like, okay, the scientific community is either going to embrace me and think, yeah, this is cool, or they're going to shun me forever and I'm done.
Or both.
Yeah, right. And I suppose maybe it is a combination of both.
I think there's a mix. We've talked about this before.
Yeah,
there's a
for
mix.
Sure. I mean, but you can't argue with 50 million views. So, you know, right. Or like, I guess you can, but but I will choose not to. So it was well received in terms of viewership, and I, you know, it's a good series. It's well written. I know because I wrote it.
So did you have any strange backlash? Or, you know, I mean, I would assume yes, because it's the internet.
Right. Well, you know, I have this rule. I don't read YouTube comments. I just don't. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, one could waste a lot of one's life and energy and time reading YouTube comments. So that's where I draw the line. So I'm sure there's been some interesting conversations over there that I don't know about, and I'm sure there's maybe been a lot of hate of me. I don't even know because I don't read it. I try to engage in conversations on my Facebook page or other places that there are, you know, that conversations tend to be more constructive. So really and truly, with that caveat that I simply hadn't looked, I would say that, you know, really the feedback that I've received has been very positive and really constructive and just of interest, really. But I guess I'm not sure how. Do you read your comments, Joanne? I don't know.
No,
not smart.
It's a waste of time.
Yeah, agreed.
Because not only is it the internet.
I apologize to the people who actually say really lovely things.
Yeah,
yeah, right. But you understand. You live on the internet too, so you just can't read, you know, and yeah. But so that series got you invited to a TED Talk, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the organizer of TED Global, Bruno Guassani, saw this series. Actually, and he saw it really early on, and I think only, you know, six or seven episodes were out. and took a chance again. I'm so lucky. Took a chance to invite me to speak at TED because, you know, it was quite, I guess, you know, out there for a TED talk. Yeah. But, it ended up being well received. I remember I was speaking at the very beginning of the conference, and it sort of was one of those ones that people were like, whoo, hoo, hoo, talking about, better part of the week. You know, I spent one part of the talk talking about the paper nautilus. Sure. Penis that kind of detaches from the male and swims through using pheromonal cues to find the female. And of course, all the males in the audience were like, whoa! Yeah. Like, does it come
this
back?
This is my whole identity,
right?
So, what would I do?
The people at Autodesk during the rest of the conference, they got to work and they made me a 3D printed paper nautilus penis.
Nice.
To present to me later on in the conference. So, you know, I think, again, even though it's not a topic that's usually associated with the TED Talk, I think people were maybe horrified to begin, but then really relieved to enjoy it and to talk about it and to laugh about it and to just be like, yep. And then I was very happy to have the book deal follow from...
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And your version in the UK is called The Nature of Sex?
That's correct. Yes. They went for the sort of the more safe. I guess safe is the
more British version.
The more British version. The book itself is the same, but I don't know. I personally like the Wild Sex title because it is literally wild sex.
Yeah, it is, and it has the double entendre, so you know. It's funny, you know, we've had Chad Orzel on, and he had the book, How to Teach Physics to Your Dog. I had a friend of mine find it in the pets and gardening section. So I wouldn't be surprised if your book does not end up in other sections of the bookstore.
If you Google it on Amazon.com, or if you just search it on Amazon.com, it comes up first, right? But then all the other ones underneath it are all, like, you know, positions and, you know, all sorts of
exactly.
Fun things. But, you know, I've had to remove my email filters and stuff, you know, long ago, because otherwise I wouldn't receive half the emails that are actually intended for me. So,
yes, if it says wild sex, then it's like, whoops.
Thinking particularly of your TED Talk, but also the book and talking about the book, don't you think that since people think about sex all the time and deny that they think about sex all the time, don't you think people find it somewhat liberating that there's a chance to hear the word penis and vagina, maybe even use them without, you know, too much self-consciousness? We need to get there somehow.
Yeah. I sure hope so. I sure hope so. And especially, you know, you think, are we really still tripping over those words, you know?
Yes.
I'm certainly not the first person to write about sex and to have a book about sex that goes on in the animal kingdom.
It's a hard climb ever since Kinsey wrote about it. People are going to make assumptions about you, and they're probably going to comment on how you're dressed as a slutty woman because you write about sex and things like that. There's a lot of messed up stuff.
Yeah.
But I think it's liberating, and the thing that I'm old enough to remember... when the evening news, when suddenly the planet Uranus became known as Uranus, because the first Voyager was about to reach it, and Dan Rather was going to have to talk about it, and I'm guessing he was too embarrassed to say Uranus, and suddenly the planet became Uranus. And then there was Lorena Bobbitt, and so all of America had to practice hearing the word penis. And then we had the vagina monologues, and people just go crazy, you know, about using that word. Are we ever going to get there, though?
I know. I don't know. I know that I don't know. I think it's maybe not as much of an uphill climb as it once was. Mm-hmm. And I remember even sort of going onto that stage at TED, and the first thing I said was, anybody thought about sex today? And I got one hand.
Yeah.
And I think everybody else was like, and it's like, are you serious, guys? Like, really? Because, you know, on the flip side of that coin, we have this, right? Like, maybe. We have the, you know, the sort of the poly community is, or the non-monogamy community is, or the, you know, the whole sort of sexual movement communities that are laughing at the rest of the world and going, you guys, really?
Well, so there's there's a famous joke about a room full of men and the guy who says, you know, show with your hands how many people have masturbated in the last week, and one guy does. He says, and the rest of you are lying.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it is, it's very interesting. I mean, if you put that in the context of apes, I mean, what would other animals do that? I mean, the bonobos are sitting over there having sex laughing at us, right? Well, yeah. I don't know, but you guys can sit there and argue about it and pretend that it doesn't happen, but we're just going to have sex.
right. You know, speaking of using sex, talking about sex, but also using sex appeal in getting a message across, you have a couple of very fun videos.
Yes.
The one that was based on Miley Cyrus' Wrecking Ball, and then, of course, I can't
no
even think
spine.
Of the I know. I was trying to think of the original song, but I'm thinking of No Spines. I
learned laugh.
No spine.
So, and your point was using popular culture and the sex appeal of these music videos to send important biological messages.
Yeah.
Right?
And I
so
mean,
the,
yeah.
The Wrecking Ball one was genius for evolution, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, you know, although I don't know the people who are really steadfastly against evolution would be the ones watching it.
I know, right? Preach it to the choir a little bit.
Exactly.
But it was fun. I mean, who couldn't parody? Like, there were so many parodies of that video, but it was just such a great opportunity. And
so how did you do that? Because you sort of did that yourself.
I did, yeah. I've gotten a couple of skills throughout the years, not many, but yeah, I got a little camera, and I had a friend come and help me shoot the parts that I couldn't shoot myself. Mm-hmm. And I had another friend who had who's a realtor and had a building that was just kind of at drywall stage, and he's like, have at her, just come. And I, you know, the wrecking ball that I used was just a big fishing buoy.
Yeah.
And I went to Home Depot, and it was great, because I went to Home Depot, and there was a guy there, Cal, you know, older guy, and I said, Cal, have you ever seen the video Wrecking Ball? And he's like, actually, yes, I have seen that. I mean, who hasn't? So I was like, okay, Cal, so I need a sledgehammer, I have this fishing buoy, I need to, like, strap it up to the wall somehow, and I'm going to swing on it naked in the name of evolution. And he was like, okay. So it ended up that they didn't rent sledgehammers, but Cal's sweetheart, he actually gave me his address and said, here, you can borrow my sledgehammer. So
nice.
I borrowed Cal's, and he gave me the right sort of tools and things I needed to string up the wrecking ball. It was awesome. You know, I got him a Tim Hortons, in very Canadian fashion, I got him a Tim Hortons gift certificate.
Sure, sure. Very nice. So,
thank you, Cal.
Yeah, really. And
I took my 10-year-old shopping with me to get the bricks, and I was like, okay, we're going to build a wall for Mummy's wrecking ball wall. I mean, my kids all think it's funny, right? And it has to be.
That's awesome. So, and then the no spines.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Wait. You had a very attractive gentleman in this one.
appeal of the model of the male, the guy wearing the Speedo with the snails crawling over him, I found had a certain something going for it.
Yeah, you know, and he's a great sport, a friend of mine, again,
yeah.
Who, he, you know, I just said, would you do this? Would you help me out with this video? And, of course, the actual Blurred Lines video is obviously very misogynistic. It's got the Robin Thicke character in the suit, right? And then the women who are almost naked. So we sort of just switch those roles.
Mm-hmm.
For fun, you know, it's not the answer to the world. I understand. There's, you know, I am using him for his sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it was, we had a great time. My friend Mike Hopcraft has a reptile rescue center, so he brought he didn't bring reptiles, but he brought all of his little bugs and spiders and things.
The spiders and the snails and the...
The snails I just collected from my garden. My kids collected
Those squid things looked awfully squishy.
Yep. I went to a seafood supply store for the octopus, and it's funny because the guy who was helping me with my taxes, he's like, why is there a receipt for an octopus? I'm like, no, that was a legitimate work expense.
<That's>
but
awesome.
It was fun. I mean, I still sing that song, and I know actually of a lot of professors that teach invertebrate classes, just sort of invertebrate taxonomy class. I mean, such a catchy little tune, and you can remember your major phylums of invertebrates by singing it.
Yeah.
Right? There you go.
I suspect we'll be linking to that video.
I hope so.
Let me ask here, what now, you know, you've written a book, you've been on TV, you've made all these great videos, what's next?
Yeah, well, you know, interestingly, I'm sort of going in another direction now. I guess maybe I'm a perpetual student, but I'm back in school again, and I'm this time taking classes in psychotherapy and psychology, and I'm becoming a registered professional therapist. And I think maybe my sort of obsession with animals and human behavior, I've always been weighted much more towards my understanding of biology, and that's where all of my education is. And so now I'm kind of going and looking at psychology stuff of humans and learning a lot about basal processes in our species, which is something I've only ever known firsthand of my own processes that occur in my head. But I think it's interesting because we have so much of our resources dedicated towards the art and the science of psychology. And I just think, well, gosh, you know, are there chimps with bipolar? Like, are there, like, I mean, there's so many questions that I have now that are kind of arising using this new knowledge that I have in psychology with biology, and I think there's a lot more exciting directions to go, but for now, yeah, I'm kind of focusing more on the human animal.
Interesting. So, I mean, it is, of course, you know, Robert Sapolsky, which biologists does not, but zebras don't get ulcers, but you may still find some yet.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I mean, well, our diet is a little bit conducive to it, I suppose. But yeah, but there's so many complexities in many mammal brains. I mean, we've come from an era where when I was first in school, we discerned ourselves from other animals by the fact that we use tools. Like, right. Oh, okay, now we know that, like, most animals, you know, in several phyla, from birds to fish and many others,
use tools.
And so we're learning so quickly about how things are much more inclusive and humbling to us. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe we will find that there are a lot of these psychological maladies. I mean, I guess the thing is language. I mean, how do you ask? How do you ask another animal how they're feeling about something? Mm-hmm. But something that I find fascinating is that there's a lot of studies going on the topic of personality, because, you know, we as biologists, again, and Joanne, you probably agree that we look at, you know, those animals as being animals, and we don't go, okay, well, that one is the cranky one, and that one is always looking to make everybody happy, and
Who owns pets knows.
Oh, absolutely.
Personality, and we've spoken to a few people, you know, about animal intelligence, and there are so many more we could still speak with, and it's, you know, it's pretty fascinating.
Intelligence, emotion, personality, things that go along with that. And so, yeah, my Animal Planet show, and I know it's in Canada, it's on Netflix, but in the States, it'll be on Animal Planet, World's Oddest Animal Couples. And that has to do with the emotion and the personality of animals and how they form bonds that, you know, we can't tell, you know, if two zebras are happy or mad or a couple or related. But if a zebra is all of a sudden friends with a rhino, then we're like, wait a second. Zebra don't speak rhino, so how's that working?
What's going on, right?
Yeah, these are the unique opportunities that give us the ability to look into the capacity for animals to form friendships or other kinds of relationships outside of their own species, and that's very interesting, yeah.
Maybe we should do some experiments, because you mentioned zebras and how to tell, and a couple things came to mind about a way, being a physicist, a way you might be able to tell whether they were happy with each other or not happy with each other. We can talk about that later, but now that we're back to sex and relationships, I wanted to quote something and make you talk about it. You said, sex is not always easy. In fact, carefree sex under the umbrella of romance and camaraderie is something that our species is virtually alone in enjoying. And now we're back to chimps and bonobos too, I think. But and we think this is what sex is, somehow humans are better at it or something, I don't know. the idea of better doesn't make much sense here either, does it?
No.
So what about, and you didn't talk a lot because that humans was not the thrust of your thing, but this separating of sex and the idea that that we enjoy sex, and maybe animals enjoy sex sometimes, although some of the behavioral things are hard to see, would be very enjoyable, like the spine in the head and things like that. But and that's another neurotic thing about humans, too. It's like, oh, no, we shouldn't enjoy it. But it is enjoyable. And that might be another question. It's like, is the orgasm subject to evolutionary selective pressure?
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's even that recent paper that came out.
I didn't see it.
Oh, everybody, Carl Zimmer wrote about it. Everybody's written about it. But apparently, someone's written a paper where they really feel like maybe 150 million years ago, you know, because there's still questions. Why is there an orgasm for females, right? Why is this, you know, because it seems pretty clear why men have it. And that, so a recent paper seems to indicate they think 150 million years ago, this was required for egg release.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. But of course, the article brings up the other reasons we think, and you bring them up in the book.
I do, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, essentially, you look at the existence of orgasm, we can assume that it occurs in all mammals, all female mammals anyway, that have a clitoris. Of course, in all male mammals, and that's how the release happens. But yes, one of the main arguments there, again, as well, and that's really interesting, what you just said about egg release, Joanne, is that, of course, the clitoris is a vestigial penis. So it's a real important structure in a male, and it comes along in the female because we couldn't possibly get along without it in the male. You know, when you think about nipples and males, why do males have nipples? Well, because females need them. And so it's part of our physiology. It's part of our makeup. And it's really an important, important structure. You know, and there's always been a lot of hypotheses to do with the fact that, yeah, like, we females can really enjoy sex. Although the composure of an orgasm in a human male versus a human female, they're really vastly different. The male is a largely tactical, physical sensation that is fairly predictable in terms of how it happens. Whereas for females, it's a largely psychological and emotional experience. And interestingly, in experiments done with female chimps or female and male chimps, but on the females specifically, they were more likely to reach orgasm when they were with preferred partners. And so again, that sort of hints to the evolutionarily relevant aspect of orgasm and perhaps related to egg release. I mean, that would make a lot of sense. You know, if I'm enjoying sex, I'm obviously with a partner that I like, and in the context of the animal kingdom, that's probably the most biologically fit partner for me at the time. And so if I can facilitate getting pregnant, or, you know, releasing an egg in conjunction with releasing the sperm, that's evolutionarily a really good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it makes a ton of sense.
Oh, so this is a good time to bring up people who say silly things about sex. So who was the guy who said during rape the body knows how to shut these things down? Who was that?
Do you
remember this?
Jeff
remembers. I don't know if Karen remembers. So
I don't.
In America, there was a prominent politician.
Senator
who said,
from Missouri, I believe.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and he said, so during cases of rape, so women rarely get pregnant. So this was his argument against abortion, for instance. You know, the body shuts these things down. Well,
if it's a true rape.
Not this sort of
fakey rape. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Right. You know, I'll and do, so that I'll would argue against ovulation in response to copulation in that case. You know, there's a lot of animals where ovulation and copulation are coupled, and females would still. And then sex is coercive, or biologists call it coercive, but in the animal kingdom, that is rape. There's a lot of things that female can do called cryptic female choice after the fact, if they have been raped in other animals, to actually discourage which partners they don't want to father the child and which ones they do. I mean,
but for humans,
I mean, we are, you know, half the women in this world, I shouldn't say half, I don't really know how many, but don't even understand what the process of ovulation is or why do we get periods? What is that? This mystery visitor, like, what's the mystery? Like, oh my gosh, you know, let's understand what's happening in our biology that we're ovulating and that we're, you know, releasing this little nest that's meant for our fertilized eggs. We sort of understand so very little about our biology. It would be, you know, if something like that were indeed the case, which I, you know, I mean, obviously that's not true because there are a lot of women that do actually carry children after rapes. There's so little cognizant awareness of what would be happening. That's something that, you know, I guess would fly in the face of this whole orgasm releases egg. Right. Obviously, if you're being raped, you're not having an orgasm. So you're not releasing an egg. Well, there are women who do get pregnant from rape. So
it was, by the way, Congressman Todd Akin.
Yes, okay.
Recently, and he was referring to what he called legitimate rape, which is another very male-centric view of the fact that women should not enjoy sex, should not have orgasms, and probably complain that everything is rape when they're just not feeling good, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So this has been taken all over the internet. So, and then the other silly thing. And I don't know if he weighed in on this argument, was Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is wonderful in so many ways, but then he said, if there were ever a species for whom sex hurt, it surely went extinct long ago. By the book, it just...
Actually, I offered to send him a copy of the book after that tweet, but I didn't get an answer. I mean, the fact of the matter is, as you guys have already alluded to in our conversation, most of the sex that happens in the animal kingdom is not happy sex. It is not candles, chocolate, you know, soft music. It is violent and horrible, and, you know, I will hold you down by your eyeballs while I stab you with my razor-sharp penis and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, he's very ill-informed of that quote. But I do get people that have that argument, like, why would an animal have sex if it doesn't feel good? And that's, again, us ascribing our own nature onto that of other beings that may have a clearer, that's kind of anthropomorphic in and of itself, a clearer picture of their biological fitness. They understand what it is they're doing on a level that we can't really comprehend. It's not I need to have sex and procreate now. It's not like that, but it is an instinctual thing that happens. And sure, it is not fun. And I mean, the sheer structures that you were alluding to, Jeff, have evolved to sort of facilitate the process. And there's almost these arms races that go on because a male has a weapon and then a female evolves a weapon to deal with that weapon. And then, you know, we see this all over the place and it's fascinating. I mean, the deed needs to get done. That's basically the bottom line. Yeah.
Which brings us very close to a question that I wanted to hear for me. You were talking, I would say, is this a big difference between men and women? And you suggested maybe these big differences come down evolutionary to the comparison of the reproductive cost of producing eggs, which takes a lot of work, and producing sperm, which we guys do by the millions, and that you suggest that leads to a very natural sexual antagonism, and that sort of causes this divergence of things or something like that?
Absolutely, and that's why I was a little bit, or more than a little bit, I'm sure you were too, Joanne, troubled by Neil deGrasse Tyson's tweet, because it basically spoke to the fact that, you know, even this real basic notion of eggs expensive, sperm cheap, as you just said, it just alluded to such a lack of basic knowledge about biology, which is unfortunate because he is one of the greatest sort of spokespeople for science in general. I know he is an astrophysicist himself.
He is, but you should never let astrophysicists do a biologist's job, really. It's just not safe, let me tell you.
I agree on that, and I won't step on their toes either.
Right? So. I'm not commenting on quirks and whatever else.
Yeah,
are.
Black holes.
On the other hand, yeah. It could be a great learning experience. Think of all the people who identify with Neil and say, yeah, he's right, he's right. And then if the backlash is big enough, they have to go, whoa, he was wrong.
Yeah.
And they may actually have heard that. And now they'll go, we know, and read your book and find out that, yeah, it's an arms race and a hot war, and, mm-hmm. and people are out there poking things and killing people and eating their mates and being cannibals and saving sperm and
playing tricks and you know. So actually we are getting near the end of the hour. Karen, is there anything we did not talk about that we should mention you'd like to speak up about?
No, I mean, it's just been wonderful to come and talk about all this stuff with you guys, and thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. It's great to see you again, Joanne.
I know. I'm really glad you could come on, and I'm really glad you wrote your book because it was in there, right?
Definitely. It was in there, right, yeah.
Yes, and definitely this book is like a giant tour of the animal kingdom. Oh, and I want to make sure to mention, because it's a good book, and we haven't had Robert Martin on yet, but he wrote a book, in case you're interested in humans, from a biological, a primatological, you know, perspective, we have a book called How We Do It, The Evolution and Future of Human Reproduction. And this book just has so much great information. Karen, you said you read it and reviewed it, and it's written so lovely. He's a great writer, and he's such a marvelous person. And so that's a good one if you want to learn about human evolution or human reproduction and its evolution and its role. But I think, you know, if you're going to talk about evolution, then you need to sort of read this book because, you know, there's a lot of evolutionary forces and natural selection forces at work in keeping animals, creating new animals, right?
For everyone with a parochial, or even if they think they have a wide open view of what sex might be in the animal kingdom, there's going to be something in here to surprise them. And that makes it like foreign travel. It's a broadening experience.
I like that.
Plus the chance to practice saying penis and vagina and those other words, yeah.
You know, and it just amazes me to go, so did you consult a lot of research papers to make this happen?
Yeah. Almost 800.
800, mm-hmm. Yes. It's just like, you know, I thought every single thing you mentioned, some scientist has studied.
Yeah.
You didn't just make this up or someone just offhandedly said this one.
Yeah.
There
are a bunch of references in the back, too, which is useful.
Yes, they're all there.
Glossary and references. So, very good. Oh, it's so nice to have you on today, Karen, and I'm glad to hear things are going well. And everybody, thank you for watching today. We are so glad you could join us. And actually, in a couple of weeks, we will be talking to Christy Wilcox about her book, Venomous.
Actually, so. You mentioned my glossary. Christy actually did the glossary.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, Christy's a good friend, and she helped me out a lot.
That's cool. Awesome. Yes, because glossaries aren't necessarily fun.
I know. She's a love for helping me out with that.
That's great. I'm glad to hear of that connection. So maybe I'll go back and read your acknowledgments now.
Yes, exactly.
So, okay, everybody, thank you for joining us with Dr. Karen Bondar. And we will see you again in the near future. And Jeff, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Karen.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, bye.